Jenna Fisher.
And I'm Angela Kinsey.
And together we have the podcast Office Ladies.
Just because we finished rewatching The Office does not mean we're going anywhere.
Every Wednesday, we'll be sharing even more exclusive stories from The Office and our friendship with brand new guests. Plus, you can revisit all the Office Ladies rewatch episodes every Monday with new bonus tidbits before every episode.
So follow and listen to Office Ladies on the free Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back into the show. I'm Sloan Martin, filling in for Esme Murphy. She will be back next week. I've been saying that throughout the show. There could be a Timberwolves game that could knock her out. I'm not totally sure, but you can expect her to be back very soon. Our next segment here, I was going to take some time to talk about something in the sports world that you may have seen this week. I know we reported it in the WCCO newsroom, where you normally can catch me here on the station, and that is about Maya Moore, the star of the Lynx, the player who was drafted in 2011, first overall, and really led this team to its four championships in 7 years. Of course, great players around her, but that is why teams tank. That's why you want to get the number one pick, so you end up with someone like Maya Moore, who could go down as the all-time greatest player in women's basketball. And in case you missed it, she announced this week with a statement, a story on the Players Tribune, which is a website that is, if you're not familiar with it, it's basically written from the players' perspective. So it's different than a press release. It's different than a regular article, where you're also getting that context from the writer, information from the author. This is directly their words, we're to understand. And she announced that she is not playing professional basketball at all for 2019. And that left a lot of questions, and left a lot of questions about the direction of the Lynx, a team that is the gold standard in the WNBA in terms of how its organization operates, how it wins, what the game atmosphere is like, and how fans here have rewarded them by buying tickets and being in the stands. And now this league, the WNBA, which just recently is going into, I believe, its 22nd season. The Lynx just last year celebrated the franchise's 20th season. It's going to be missing one of its biggest stars. And there has been a lot of really positive remarks. So what she said is that she is looking to basically redirect her life, at least for the next year. We don't know what's going to happen in 2020. We can maybe assume she's going to play basketball again. She did sign a multi-year contract with the Lynx. Also, the Olympics are next year, too, and she figures to be a starter on that team to try and get yet another gold medal. But at least for 2019, she's not playing. She's not playing overseas, which is something that women's basketball players pretty much have to do unless they want to settle for a WNBA contract, which for her is not chump change by any means. It is for a professional athlete standard, but for her, she's making in the range of $115,000 to $117,000 a year just from the WNBA, just from the Lynx, by that max contract that she has. But it's a lot that these players have to go through. So she's finally, after dedicating so much of her life, year-round basketball, playing in Russia, playing in other completely faraway parts of the world, never taking a break, she's deciding that this year, 2019, she's going to turn 30 in June, is the year that she's going to step away. And her reason for doing that, in what she's written in the Players Tribune, if you didn't catch the news this week, is because she has ministry dreams. She has spoken about social justice causes. If you look at her Twitter right now, her most recent tweet is about human trafficking. She's talked about wrongful imprisonment. And clearly her Christian faith is extremely important to her. She signs all of her autographs with Colossians chapter 3, verse 23. And it's very important to her. We've seen a lot of really good remarks, I would say, which is just kind of blows my mind when you combine the internet and social media combined with a women's basketball player. Sometimes you don't always see the nicest comments, but they have been very, very much positive. And when it comes to discussing Maya Moore, I can break down the roster. I talked to Cheryl Reeve on Friday. You break down the roster, talk about what this means for the Lynx after the retirement of Lindsey Whalen. They still don't know if Rebecca Brunson, the WNBA's leading rebounder, is going to be back. But I think this speaks to a larger issue with female athletes, and that is that they have to make choices like this, that they are, so much is demanded of them throughout their entire careers, that they finally get to a point that they just need to step aside. She is in the prime of her career right now. She's going to be turning 30 years old. And even for women athletes, we're seeing that kind of age curve continue to be pushed back, just like with men, as players understand rest and nutrition and how to take care of their bodies and how to treat their bodies in the off season. We see players playing at a high level until they get even older, but it still comes off as a loss for the league. And sometimes I think fans here locally would maybe even feel guilty to say that, because her stated intentions are so respectable, that she wants to take this time. She doesn't specify exactly what she wants to do. She talks about her ministry dreams that have been stirring in her heart for many years. I'm reading her article on the Players Tribune. She'll miss her day-to-day relationships with her teammates, but this no to pro basketball in 2019 allows her to say yes to her family and faith family like she never has before. And this is such a different situation from so many male athletes who are paid 10 times as much. That's not even the right math. It's even a lot more than that, than what Maya Moore is paid. And they can maybe have a better connection. They can have that sense of purpose, even though basketball or any professional sport is going to be a year-round endeavor. But when you are talking about from high school playing year-round to being a player at the University of Connecticut, the number one overall pick, and never stopping, it's a lot of demand on your mind and your heart. And she, it's very rare. We see players who do step away from the WNBA for a year, but not like this. This is what makes it unique. I was reading a story in the Hartford Courant. Gino Auriemma, who was her college coach at the University of Connecticut, I thought he really summed it up well. He said, it's probably a big surprise to a lot of people because she's still in the prime of her career. She's had so much success when you think about it. But people change as they get older. Things that were not as important become really important. She sees something out there that she feels like she has to devote more of her time to, and I'm all for it. If that's what you've got to do, that's what you've got to do. So it's not so much a critique by any means of her own decision. It really, to me, speaks a lot about what female athletes have to go through. And sometimes you just have to take off the weight, because they also so many times have to represent women. They have to represent women playing sports. If you could only see the kind of vitriol and sexism that gets sent their way on social media when these are such high-level, talented athletes, they have to represent this entire league with every time they're on the floor, every statement they make, and make people they have to convince people that they are worthy enough to play this sport, that they are good enough, and they are deserving of your respect, which of course they are. But she is deciding to kind of step away from that, and she'll still be doing good works, it seems, whatever those ministry dreams are, what she talked about, but she's going to be doing it in a much different way. Now, transitioning it to the Lynx a little bit, you have Simone Augustus, who's going to be coming back for her 13th year, but there are a lot of questions about what's going to happen to this team. This Lynx organization made so many people, and this goes for especially Lindsey Whalen, people are so attached to her. She is the Mount Rushmore of Minnesota sports overall. There's no denying that she would be up there all time. But this franchise has enlightened so many people to what women athletes are capable of, what they can achieve, and what can happen when you put the effort in, when you put the resources in, and when you win. the kind of support that comes out of that. I was looking up at attendance figures. The Minnesota Lynx were second last year behind Los Angeles. This is still a team or a league that continues to grow. You think about where the NBA was about 20 years into its development, and you had a player who was capable of scoring 100 points in a game and averaging 50 rebounds a game. Things have really come a long way since then. So to pluck out a star player, someone who is a face of a league, someone who was on a billboard mimicking a Michael Jordan iconic pose, his Wings poster. If you caught that over the summer, they gave away that poster to a couple thousand fans, I believe in June. And she was part of that Jordan campaign. If you go to Nike Women's Basketball, or rather Nike Women, just to buy clothes, no matter what sport you're into, she is on that website. She is the face of Nike Women and Jordan basketball. This obviously must be so important to her to be able to walk away from that. So, of course, fans are going to question what's going to happen to the Lynx. Can they win this year? What's happening to the dynasty? But it's important to think of, too, maybe the effect that Maya Moore can have really dedicating herself this year to what's important to her, these social justice, these faith initiatives that are so deeply a part of her. And it makes you think about athletes maybe a little bit differently. And I wonder how many others are maybe feeling that same pull, but maybe aren't able to at this time. So we're going to take a break. Shaletta Brundage has come in as the producer, and we're going to talk a little bit about Valentine's Day. That's coming up this week. I think we can have some fun with that, Shaletta. She's nodding her head. All right, we're going to step aside for a break. We'll have more here on Saturday Night with Sloan. I feel like I need an extremely low voice to talk over this for Valentine's Day. It's Sloan Martin filling in for Esme Murphy.
Your very wide voice.
Yeah, you know what? No masking that. That's exactly right. Jonathan, come back here.
Right.
He was giving me some big voice introductions when we first came in because I didn't get one for filling in with Esme.
Oh.
For Esme. So you're not able to do that for me.
No, ma'am. I'm not even going to try.
Yeah. Well, that's all right.
Sorry.
I wanted to take this time to talk about Valentine's Day. It is Thursday, and I'm sure our fellow WCCO radio host, Dara Moskowitz-Grumdahl, would tell you should already have your reservations for all the big places, so I'm not going to pretend I really know about the restaurant scene. I feel like we've done stories in the WCCO newsroom about gotta have those things done well in advance, but that doesn't mean you can't have a great time. So I am more of an experience person, Shaletta.
What do you mean by that?
That means that for me, it's not about, and it's not to say that one is better than the other. For me, it's not about flowers, although you can get me chocolate-covered strawberries any day
Cherry's
of the
berries,
year.
Cherry's berries, baby.
Hint. It's not about flowers. It is not about the major gifts. And it's proven that men spend significantly more on Valentine's Day than women. So it's not about the jewelry or anything else. I want to have a fun time. I think I've made it pretty clear in this show here that I've put together that I kind of like nerdy things. I want to go to a museum. I want to go to a basketball game.
You want to go to a museum for Valentine's
Shaletta,
Day?
Yes.
Girl,
I'm not ashamed of that.
You should have heard that. That's,
I mean, if you, that's what I'm saying.
Valentine's
if you like,
Day.
If you like a more traditional thing, you want a candlelit dinner,
the
that's
rose
fine.
The petals and the wine and the
Have you had a, like, dream Valentine's Day in your life? Like, that just was everything you wanted.
You know what? I did. It was a couple of years before my husband and I got married. We were in Houston. You know,
but it was your husband?
It was my husband, the one I'm married to right now. Mm-hmm.
Oh, you said, I'm sorry, I thought you said before you got married?
Before I got married
okay,
to my husband.
Same
but
person.
It was my husband, yeah. Because, you know, you got to make them think they're the only person you ever dated.
Oh,
so,
yeah,
it was my husband. And we were both struggling, just fresh out of college. He had just finished graduating from medical school, so he was doing like an internship, and I was in my first TV job, and we didn't have a lot of money. And so what he did was he gave me a foot massage. Like with the paraffin wax and the little bubbles, and he had the rocks and he had the salts. Ooh. And it was so nice, and he massaged my feet. And then we had dinner and we played Operation with our feet. You know, and so I'm a homebody. So if I can stay home and eat a good meal and laugh, because I love to laugh, then that's like the perfect Valentine's Day for me. I don't want to be elbow to elbow at the restaurant to get overcharged. Yeah. I don't want, you know, the flowers to come in a box and I got to cut them and put them together. I just want, you know, to laugh and have fun and eat good food.
You know what? I really like that sentiment a lot. And it's just a show that there are women out there. There's no, like, you know, it doesn't have to be like this demanding thing. Maybe there are people who do put a lot more into Valentine's Day and really see it as like, this is an expression of love and you better show it right here, right now.
Or you don't love me. If you don't do it right, you don't love me.
Well, that's the thing. You want to listen to your significant other and take into account how they feel about it, because it might be really important to them. And you want to show that you're making that effort, that you're listening to them. I don't have like as nice of a story. It just hasn't always been kind of the forefront.
Rose petals and wines.
Oh,
and chocolates.
Wow.
And yeah.
Have you had that too?
No, I don't even want that. And you know who puts the pressure on the men? It's the commercials.
Oh.
I mean, if you watch ESPN as much as I do, because we both love sports.
Yeah.
Watch ESPN right now in the month of February. Every commercial is sponsored by K Jewelers or Jared, or give her something she loves, or make her smile, or every kiss begins with K. And so these men are sitting up there watching these sports, and a commercial comes on, and you keep getting bombarded that this is the only way to make a woman smile. So it gets real materialistic and expensive by the end of the football game.
It is a huge holiday economically, where people are spending, they can spend hundreds, thousands of dollars even. I don't have the numbers in front of me, but I know from last year, it is something that brings in annually a couple billion dollars.
God. That's ridiculous
in terms of
to
revenue.
Even think about.
No, it's definitely an interesting holiday. I've never met someone who's like extremely into it, who is wants to go all out every single time. But obviously they're out there.
Of course. We just don't hang in those circles, because that's not how we, that's not how we roll. So that's not how our friends roll either. Because we'd be like, girl, what do you, could take that money and do so much more with it.
But there's, that's right. There's got to be, though, I mean, is there going to be like a revolt against restaurants? Like, obviously they're great to go every other day of the year. But like, are both couples and single people just going to be like, this isn't worth it?
No, because people like it. They enjoy it and they look forward to it. I mean, you know, I don't hang with those people, but I know them. And they are like, oh my God, I can't wait. You know, and they've been talking about it since Christmas. It's like a second version of Christmas. It's like Christmas for the grownups. Because they're like, I'm going to get a gift. I'm going to go out to eat, and he's going to spend money, and I'm going to get my flowers. It's almost like Santa Claus is coming, but in the shape of a heart.
This is my very kind of sappy, kind of cliched take about Valentine's Day, and that's that you should treat every day like it's your anniversary. Treat every day like it's your Valentine's
you.
Day.
That's so
okay.
Sweet. And we would have no D words. I don't even like to say the D word.
Oh, yeah.
We would have no D words if we did that.
That is my humble advice as a person who's been married for 5, going on 6 years later this year.
Girl, y'all almost veterans.
Yes. I mean, five years, that's a big deal, okay?
That is. That's a big deal. Yeah. You're almost a veteran, girl.
And we've done it without a lot of Valentine's Day. But that's more power to you if you enjoy to go the traditional route. We're still going to be here for the next half an hour. If you feel like sharing, I was about to say your Valentine's fantasy. Do not share your Valentine's
girl,
Day fantasy.
I was going to say, wait a minute now. Hold
I
on,
I want to hear what is either.
Wait a minute.
I want to hear what is either Valentine's Day, whether that's imagined or something that's happened, or kind of what you think is like the best experience for Valentine's Day. The text number is 81807. You can text us again, 81807, because it's coming up here on Thursday. If you don't have your plans in place, maybe this can help you. You probably should have those plans, though. If you
I was going to say, yeah, if you have a major reservation, yeah, you should go grocery shopping, because you're going to be cooking at home.
That's exactly right. All right, we're going to step aside for one more break. Coming up, I will be having a chat with Alana Semuel. She's a writer for The Atlantic. We talked about how the demographics around youth football, high school football, and even up into college and the NFL, how those demographics are changing and why. We'll have that coming up here on WCCO. Welcome back to Saturday Night with Esme on WCCO. I'm Sloan Martin filling in. Research shows the number of kids participating in football is declining as more parents realize the risk of brain damage. We've heard a lot about this in regards to the NFL and retired players. Even President Trump said recently he would not let Barron, his son, play football after hearing former players themselves be cautious about letting their own children play the game. My next guest is Alana Semuel, a writer for The Atlantic. In an article published this week, she writes about how that's the case for some families, but not all communities are seeing that trend. Alana, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
The title of your article, The White Flight from Football, kind of gives away my first question, which is, what are we seeing in regards to football participation from youth through high school, and how is that differing for different communities, parts of the country, and especially along racial and socioeconomic lines?
Yeah, it's really interesting because it was hard to get data. I had to really dig into a lot of different data for this, but generally we're seeing participation in youth football, high school football decline, especially in majority white states and majority white communities. And then it's growing in some states, majority black states and black communities. So one number is about 29% of white students, men, play football, and 44% of black students.
No, that's certainly a divide, and you bring up in your article, too, how that's changed over time, just the demographics of how football has changed, even through Division I and the NFL.
Yeah, so in Division I, white football players used to make up about half, and now they're about 37%, and black football players now make up about half of Division I college football players, and they were about 39% just 20 years ago. And then if you look at the NFL, it's even a bigger divide. A large majority of NFL players today are black, and just a few decades ago, it was only about half.
Now, some families you talked to in rural rural Georgia County that you reported in, what did they have to say about keeping their sons playing football? There were some that you quoted that, you know, did acknowledge the risk, but there was a lot that they saw the benefits in.
Yeah, it was really interesting because they saw football as something that was really good for their kids. They lived in these places where there wasn't a whole lot of other activities, and there's a lot of not great stuff going on, like gang activity and crimes. And so this mother said to me, and a few different parents said this, you know, I want to keep my kids out of trouble. Football is the best way to keep them out of trouble. You know, they're going to have something to do on the weekends. They're going to have practice to go to after school. They're going to have coaches who really take an interest in them. They're going to be traveling with the team, and they're just going to have something to really throw themselves into that they love. And so, you know, these parents were kind of saying to me, if the choice is between tackle football and gangs, I'm obviously going to choose tackle football, and I think that's a very rational choice.
It seems like there's also this continuing idea that it could create opportunities later in life. It's such a small percentage, and I don't know this offhand, but just from reading and following sports throughout my life, about the odds to become a Division I football player, to have that scholarship. But there's still a chance that they will do that, and that's enough, it seems like.
Yeah, I think especially in the South and Southeast, where Division I college football is a really big deal, and a lot of universities are offering it. A lot of parents see this as a way that will help kids pay for college or help them get into college. And it's, you know, the number of scholarships, Division I scholarships available for football has really grown as football becomes more lucrative for schools. So, you know, now you have these bowl games. You have a bowl game for almost everything, and that can bring in a lot of revenue for schools. You have about 3,000 more scholarships available than you did 30 years ago for football, tackle football in Division I, whereas other sports actually offer fewer scholarships, and there are fewer schools offering scholarships. I looked at swimming in particular, and there are 31 fewer schools that offer swimming, men's swimming and diving scholarships than in 1988, and 62 more Division I schools that offer football, in part because it can be such a moneymaker for universities.
You also talked to parents in Connecticut, I believe, who allowed their children to play hockey and really encouraged it over football. We're pulling their children out of the sport and said that what they've seen in regards to head injuries was too much. They don't want to take the risk. I'm wondering what you heard from them, because I'm wondering if it is the parents maybe not as aware of the concussion risk with, say, hockey or lacrosse, because those are certainly not safe from contact injuries, from head injuries, having those big blows in those sports. Or do you think there is just a wider cultural shift around the sport, kind of from the bottom up in football, that is taking these parents, particularly white parents and white communities, away from it?
Well, I think, you know, hockey, lacrosse are also dangerous, but from these parents' perspective, football is much more dangerous than any of the other sports. You know, I had one parent say to me, and he's a former college football player, he said, with football, you're basically trying to decimate the person in front of you, and if you're not, you're not doing a good job. And in every play in football, you can get hit. Whereas in hockey, that's not the point of the game. You know, there might be some checking, and hockey doesn't allow checking for young kids. But it's not as much woven into the fabric of the game. But I think there is something there to that discrepancy in information. And I think, you know, a lot of the parents I talked to who were pulling their kids had PhDs or medical degrees, and had a lot of access to information about CTE and brain trauma, and even, you know, seen it up close in hospitals because of the work that they did. I included one father in the story, but I talked to a bunch of others of white parents who had played football or who played hockey and weren't letting their kids play. And I think, you know, there's just a lot less access to information in some of the lower income communities. I have one professor talk to me about this idea he calls medical apartheid, which is just, you know, people in certain communities are kind of out of the loop about concussions and brain damage, and they just don't have the access to information that someone with a kind of platinum medical plan might have.
When you were in, it's Colquitt County, Georgia, correct?
Yeah, that's right.
You said they had a population of 45,000, but would regularly fill that 10,000-seat stadium. I'm wondering about your observations from kind of taking in from the six-year-olds playing tackle football all the way up to high school. And obviously the crowds are going to change, but what did you see? I mean, just watching kids that small with helmets on and playing tackle football, and then kind of the intensity as you got to the older kids.
Yeah, I mean, it was really interesting. I've grown up watching football and watching sports, and I think, you know, to some degree it's a little bit sanitized on TV. You know, in the first place, in the NFL, they're professionals. They really know what they're doing. But, you know, you're not going to see blood, or you're not going to see a lot of violence on the field on TV. But when you are sitting there in the stands and you see these little kids playing, you know, it's these very small kids who have these very heavy helmets on, whose necks look like straws or something, and they're just, you know, they're tackling because that's the sport. It's tackle football, and the hits and just the violence was very loud to me. As someone who's watched football my whole life, seeing these kids play, it just seemed much more violent than I had remembered. And then, you know, the 6 and 7 year olds, it was kind of like, you know, little kids playing soccer. Everyone kind of congregates around the ball and then they fall down. But as they get older, the kids get pretty fast and the hits are pretty hard. And, you know, by the time I was at this all-day football tournament that started with 6 and 7 year olds and went up to 14 year olds, and by the time the last game was on, the stands were pretty full. All these people had come to and paid, you know, $5 or $7 to watch this game, and it was kind of like watching, you know, college football. These kids were running really fast. They were passing. They were hitting really hard, and it was extremely, extremely violent. And you know, I think It really struck me sitting with parents. You know, sometimes I would kind of cover my eyes just because it seemed so violent. And the parents have just kind of come to accept this as this is what their kids do, and this is a good option for their kids to keep them out of trouble. And that just really struck me as something that was kind of troubling to me.
Alana Semuels joining us from The Atlantic. She wrote an article earlier this week called The White Flight from Football, about how different communities based on race, based on socioeconomic status, are either encouraging their kids to stick with football or pulling them out. When you look at suburban families, They have lacrosse. They have diving. They have golf. Some places even offer horseback riding, whatever there is, depending on the community and the region of the country you're in. They can make different choices because those choices are available. And what really struck a chord with me in your article is how you lay out that this is not necessarily about football. Of course, it is the health and the safety of the players. But it seems like all of this is related to systemic disparities, whether it's schools or communities, that these poor communities have to make different choices than more wealthy ones.
Yeah, I think that's definitely true. I mean, I think for these poorer communities, first of all, you know, if these parents are looking for something for their kids to do and something to keep them out of trouble, it's really just football, maybe baseball and basketball. There are maybe three sports that are kind of not that expensive that kids can play. If you look at, you know, upper income communities, kids have so many activities available to them. They can do music, they can do dance, you know, they can do almost anything you can imagine. And you know, even if those activities are available in poorer communities, parents often don't have the flexible schedules to drive their kids to those activities. They don't have the money to pay for a lot of extra activities. You know, I looked at diving because Colquitt County, the place I visited, actually has this powerhouse diving arena where a lot of kids go and they learn how to become divers and they get college scholarships. But you have to know how to swim to dive, and a lot of poorer kids don't know how to swim. And then you have to have someone drive you to the diving practice. You have to have someone drive you to the travel meets. It ends up being very expensive. And even this diving facility, which is, you know, a really great facility, has really tried to diversify and tried to get more kids involved. And they've had a really tough time just because, you know, a lot of these extracurriculars are kind of perceived as for upper income people and not as accessible to lower income people.
Have you seen this, or has research seen an effect on this kind of declining participation and interest in something like the NFL? You talked earlier about how these colleges are making lots of money with football. Those bowl executives are playing, making lots of money with football, but that's a different topic. But it seems like there is still that interest, even from these same families that are, you know, not having their kids get involved.
Yeah, I mean, I think we saw the NFL actually saw its ratings go up this year from the past couple of years. And so, you know, as broadcast television is really struggling to maintain ratings, football is really one of the only sure things. And it's not just the NFL, it's also college football. You know, and it's something that I struggle with too. You know, I really like watching football. I'm from Boston. I'm a Patriots fan. It's really fun to watch. Well,
of course it's been really fun to watch.
Yeah. And so, you know, when you think about the racial demographics, you think, you know, I feel bad watching this because I'm kind of supporting this system that financially lures people in to get brain damage. And so, you know, I think it's a really tough question we have to ask ourselves is, you know, what should I be doing? I don't know. I still like watching football, but I definitely feel guilty about it.
You cite Mike Wagner, the executive commissioner of Pop Warner's Southern California Conference. He said, "To demonize just this sport is unfair, it's illogical, and frankly, it's downright un-American." And that happened after the Safe Youth Football Act failed in California, a bill that would have set a minimum age for organized tackle football leagues. What are states maybe doing to take action, and what's your reaction to a quote like that, and maybe from some of the parents you talk to in rural Georgia about taking those kinds of actions?
Yeah, so there have been five states that have kind of tried to make parents' decisions for them and ban tackle football under a certain age. You know, a lot of experts say, okay, maybe we can start tackling at 14 and maybe we should just do flag until then. But, you know, I think it's those bills have had a hard time passing because there has been a lot of backlash, and there's this idea of, you know, people should be able to do whatever they want. It's this kind of American idea of, you know, personal liberty. But the problem I have with that is that it's, you know, as the story kind of shows, it's not personal liberty. It's not this freedom of choice because some parents can choose not to play and other parents feel like they can't have their kids not play. And so, you know, I think in some ways legislation would be a way to even this out. I mean, the thing that I think would work the most, and, you know, I think I've been saying this for a couple of years as I've covered kind of inequality and segregation and don't see any movement for it, but just a way to increase opportunity in these communities so that there are choices aside from football. You know, to teach kids in poorer communities, it's not just football or gangs. There are other things there as well. You know, I think that would be hard to do, especially right now in today's political climate, I'm not sure that there's a huge appetite for that. But that seems like a more democratic way to approach this than to either just ban football or not ban it.
All right. Alana Samuel, staff writer at The Atlantic, thanks so much for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
And we're going to step aside for our last break. Sloan Martin filling in for Esme Murphy here on Saturday night on WCCO. We will be right back. It's the final segment of Saturday Night with Esme. I'm Sloan Martin, who's been filling in. You can usually catch me in the WCCO newsroom, including today and all the newscasts that you've heard. It's been one of those having to juggle a lot today, but I think I had a good time. Shaletta Brundage is joining me here at the controls of the board. And we were talking off air after I had, after I was talking about Maya Moore and how difficult it is, especially as women athletes, to be able to devote yourself to something greater, what you think is your purpose, as she is doing, when you have so many demands of you and your efforts and your time, so much labor that you have to do, not just work, but your family labor, emotional labor, so much that is pulling women in so many different directions. And Shaletta, you said that really goes for so many.
That's
I brought
life.
Up women athletes because of the year-round schedule that they have for years and mm-hmm. years and years, how it never, ever stops. And you're a mother yourself.
Yeah.
And you
That's
can really
life.
Relate to this.
Yeah. Life doesn't stop. You know, there's always laundry, or there's always a dish that needs to be washed, or food that needs to be cooked, or a child has to get to an appointment, or they get sick and have to go to the doctor, and you still have to come to work and do your job for 8 hours, and your employer expects you to do your best. They don't want to hear about, you know, sick kids or, you know, whatever needs to happen. They want to know, are you going to perform? Just like Maya. You know, are you going to perform? Are you going to bring us another championship? You know, and
people are already wondering about that. Well, when is she going to come back
exactly.
again?
Exactly. And what we have to do as women and as mothers and as wives is, you know, we have to make some tough choices because we are the backbone of our families. And sometimes you have to take a break and step away. I know I did when, you know, I had one kid diagnosed with autism. I still worked. Okay. I had two kids diagnosed with autism. My mama retired. She helped me. But by the time I got to a third child with autism, I had to step away and take care of my family. I had to leave my job, stop my career, and say, I got to get home right and take care of these babies. And then once they're all squared away, I can go back.
And it's such a difficult decision. And it's, you know, no one wants to put words in her mouth because she has not spoken to the media at all, except for this 300-word article on the Players Tribune. So this is, you know, a lot of it is speculating just because she has not made any other public comment. But you think about how difficult it is when basketball or motherhood or your job or whatever it is that you want to kind of step away from is such a part of your identity. It's the reason, for her especially, you're known. It's
exactly.
what you do.
Exactly.
And that may be the same role that women carry in their own family.
Mm-hmm. Because, I mean, you are Shaletta Brundage. You work for WCCO Radio. Well, what happens when you're just Shaletta Brundage, mom of three kids with autism? Are you as important? Can you do it all? Can you, you know, and a lot of times women, you know, we go through so much and then we're stressed out and our bodies shut down on us. And, you know, my mother experienced a stroke trying to do it all. And I saw that. And so I said, you know, early on, I am going to make a conscious decision not to let this rat race of life, like you were saying, it doesn't stop, whether it's going overseas to play basketball or signing up for one more camp for your kids. Not letting that rat race of life get me to the point that I want to just, you know, give up, or I get so stressed out that I need medical attention.
And it's such a difficult thing to really put your finger on about these kind of feelings that you have. And when do you need to kind of take a break? She writes in the Players Tribune, I didn't read this before. She says, the success I've been a part of in basketball truly blows my mind every time I think about it. But the main way I measure success in life is something I don't often get to emphasize explicitly through pro ball. I measure success by asking, am I living out my purpose? I learned a long time ago that my purpose is to know Jesus and to make him known. So that's really deep. And that's what she is stepping away from, mm-hmm. this platform that she's had as a women's basketball player, because how strongly this is calling her.
And, you know, she has always been very thoughtful, you know, to have to do something like this. I'm sure it pained her because basketball is, like you said, it's been a part of who she is and how she is known. But at some point, you know, you've got to take stock in what's really important. And this is what's most important for her. And she didn't retire. You know, a lot of people read it and thought, oh, well, she's not ever coming back. She's just going to take a year off.
Right, because she actually didn't specify, like, oh, see you guys next year. I'll be back. Because she kind of left that open-ended, which I think kind of made the rumors run a little bit.
Yeah, because I think she's got to kind of see if this is it. Because, you know, being a stay-at-home mom is a lot of work. And you can start out doing that. But, girl, let me tell you, it ain't for everybody. So, you look up and you're like, I got to get to work. I got to talk to some grownups. You know, so she may start out on that path and realize I miss basketball. And that's a platform that I can use to still spread my message.
I think there were a lot of people last year. She put up very similar numbers to her career. Her shooting was a little bit down. But there were moments where you just thought, she just looks a little bit off. That doesn't look like the Maya Moore. And you can't really quantify that statistically. It was just kind of a feeling from watching her throughout these years that it just felt a little bit different in certain moments. And all of this makes me think about how you never know what people are kind of thinking, mm-hmm. what they're working through. It could be a huge moment like this. It could be just fatigue with everything that's going on in their lives. And it's something to maybe be more in tune to. And it's been nice to see so many people be understanding in this situation. Mm-hmm. I was very pleased to not see a lot thrown her way negatively. Mm-hmm. But that's a lot of people are probably thinking about this in their everyday lives.
Yeah, it's a choice that we have to make. But what I really like is how smart she was. She didn't have to hold a news conference and stress herself out and get all dressed up and take questions from the media. You know, the internet and the way things are structured in the media now, she just puts out her statement and goes on about her life. You know what I mean? She didn't have to deal with the stress of the news conference and setting up and going out and talking and taking questions. She gave her statement. We all know what's going on as much as she wants us to know. And then she's going to move on with her life. How peaceful is that?
No, it's definitely very interesting. I think a lot of people maybe would have appreciated a few more answers, but we'll be getting
that. I saw you on Twitter. You were like, I'm waiting on a phone call from Maya right now. I was
Oh, no. Maybe someday, though. 2020 or so. All right. We are almost out of time here. Thanks so much for tuning in tonight. Thank you to Jonathan Lowe, Shalita Brundage, Dave Josephson for their help in putting this together. Esme Murphy, we never checked if there was a Timberwolves game, but I'm running out of time, especially now. We'll be back next week. Tomorrow. Tomorrow we'll have Amy Klobuchar starting at around 1:30.
History That Doesn't Suck is a legit, hard-hitting American history podcast told through entertaining stories. History That Doesn't Suck, an Odyssey podcast, available wherever you get your podcasts.